Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. Hello, I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
Coming up today, we speak with All-Star Golden Glove Emmy Award winner and currently the lead analyst for MLB Network, Harold Reynolds. That is straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. But first, let's look at some of the top stories of the week. And let's begin with Tom Terrific, Tom Brady. He came back to Gillette Stadium.
Here is the scene in Foxborough. We'll let you listen and watch as Tom Brady returns as a visitor for the first time.
And, ooh, Lordy, did we watch that game across America? Lynchy, I know it meant something to you because that is your home turf. What did you think about it? And the NFL ratings were through the roof in this game.
Yeah, the second highest NFL game in recent memory. Only the Cowboys and Washington football team of about 10 years ago had a higher rating, which really surprised me because I don't think they take into account how many people are watching on tablets, on phones, on desktop computers. I don't think Nielsen has access to all those ratings. So, but this was everything it built up to be. There were no losers in this game. Brady came back. Belichick had a defense for him, and the game wasn't decided until Nick Folk's 56-yard field goal hit the upright with 52 seconds to go. And this was just an absolute bonanza. It was a huge game. Tom Brady, no surprise, was a rousing ovation, as you just heard right there. But once the game started, people were giving thumbs down to Tom. You're just an opponent.
Scarlett, I know that everybody's been talking about this game, but the biggest thing that I think about it is the NFL is always king when it comes to the four major food groups when it comes to sports.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just this game either. The NFL saying that the average game has had 17.3 million viewers this season. That is a 17% increase from the same time as 2020. Granted, 2020 is not a normal year, but still, this is kind of better than what anyone expected. And apparently, you know, Tom Brady is in the center of most of these most viewed games. The 21 most watched shows on TV since the start of the season, NFL games. What are they? Bucks versus Patriots, obviously. Cowboys versus Bucks. Cowboys versus Chargers. Bucks versus Rams. And Steelers versus Packers. So Tom Brady in three of those games. It's pretty notable.
I've got an interesting theory on all those games.
Please.
Because I've talked to a lot of people. It is the advent and the emergence of these gambling platforms, DraftKings, FanDuel, MGM, Caesars, where you used to just bet the game, the line on the game. Okay, well, I'm given 7.5 points. Or the over-under is 42. I'm taking the over, the under. But as the game continues, you can bet on who's going to score the next touchdown. You can bet on whether the game is going to end in an even number of points or an odd number of points. So right to the very, very end, until the clock reads 0-0-0, people are still gambling on the game on some different prop bet. And I know I heard from a bunch of young people who were over someone's house watching one day, and if a guy named Pat Freiermuth of the Pittsburgh Steelers caught a touchdown pass in the last 2 minutes of the game, they were going to win $900, and they kept the game on because of that. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen just a real surge at 17%, as you said, Scarlett, in viewership.
And you got to wonder whether the advertising rates for a spot near the end of the game versus the middle of the game versus the start of the game, they're going to start to be equalized.
There's gambling going on in this establishment? I'm shocked.
Yeah, right.
Let's move on to the next topic. Oh, my goodness. Let's start the golfing feud. These two guys, they've dominated the golf headlines, and they're going to come to a head-to-head meeting. Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau. They'll face off in a 12-hole match on November 26th at the Wynn Golf Club in Las Vegas. It's the mean on the green, like the Thrilla in Manila.
You should be announcing for this golf game, because I can't think of anything that would bore me more than watching golf. But if the announcer announces like you do, Barr, then I'd get into it.
I think I'd make them both mad if I started screaming as they're lining up for a putt. Here comes the Shambo. This is going to be a ratings bonanza. We were just talking about ratings, Scarlett. This is going to be a big old ratings bonanza.
And Lynchy, this is because the two guys don't like each other. They're like sworn rivals. Is that right?
Well, much of it has been captured on social media. One time, Brooks Koepka was talking, and Bryson DeChambeau, wearing metal cleats, was going clickety-clack, clickety-clack behind him. And Koepka just stopped and just shook his head and just lost his train of thought and said, where were we? And then
Wait, this is how golf players get mad at each other.
Yes. Okay. Then DeChambeau comes back and says, I'm living rent-free in Brooks Koepka's head. Then so Koepka got mad about that. So the two of them were on the same Ryder Cup team. And then when they had their press conference and team picture with the trophy, Justin Thomas suggested the two of them embrace each other and give a hug. And now we've come to this. But this is going to be good because golf is supposed to be the gentleman's game. It's polite.
Not with clickety-clack going on.
Clickety-clack going on. Yep, clickety-clack down the track.
Clickety-clack. There's going to be some smack. That's right. The mean on the green.
But you know what's interesting is that I understand that this is going to feature open mics, which is a normal thing on the players during the competition, and they'll be able to talk to each other, talk to the commentator. So we're going to be listening very closely for them trading insults.
They better have a 7-second delay.
Oh, took the words right out of my mouth, Big Mike Barb, because I got my finger on my cough button right here. And you remember the old days in the radio when the producer would sit there when you get this call in, you always have the finger on the 7-second delay button. You're
Can
right.
you do prop bets on that, on whether someone gets beeped out?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can bet on anything you want. Yep. When it comes to sports. That's going to be, by the way, I should say, Turner Sports, they're going to air that. Yep. It's going to be the day after Thanksgiving on TNT.
That's
the
good timing.
Day after Thanksgiving. Everybody's going to be watching that.
Oh, on the couch, leftovers, you know, turkey sandwich. Loosen up the belt a little bit on the couch and, you know, yeah, perfect.
This is the fifth edition of this.
Yeah.
This is the first one. It was DeChambeau and Aaron Rodgers. They faced off against Phil Mickelson and Tom Brady. But this is going to be something else. I can't wait.
Tom Brady shows up everywhere in this show.
Speaking of Boston, folks, the Boston Marathon, it is coming up. It's coming up very soon. And I'm used to it being in April for many, many years. And this is the first time I have to get my head wrapped around this. Lynchy, that it's coming up in October, right around the corner.
Yeah, and it's been on Patriots Day, the third Monday in April for a long, long time. 125th edition of the Boston Marathon. First time it was ever canceled was 2020, obviously, mm-hmm. because of the pandemic. But what this is a boon for is all the restaurants, all the hotels, all the people that work on this marathon. But most importantly, this race has become is a big, big fundraiser for charity. Over the last 20 years, the Boston Marathon has generated more than close to $500 million for local charities. In terms of economic impact for the greater Boston region, 2 years ago, the last time it was run in 2019, more than $200 million of dollars of infusion in the local economy right here. So it's a win-win for everybody. One of my sons-in-law is running on Monday. Mm. He's pretty pumped up about it. And just to add a little more congestion to the area and a lot more money coming into town, the Red Sox are hosting the Tampa Bay Rays on Monday as well. maybe a half a mile from the finish line. So it should be a jam-packed fun event on Monday here in Boston.
I was just looking at the schedule, and I think a week and a half later, the head of the Charles comes to Boston as well on October 22nd to the 24th, along with just the usual people who come in to check out the foliage and look at Boston at its finest during the fall.
Yeah, come on up. We'll show you all our championship banners, and we'll give you the tour of the town, and at no charge at all for the two of you. How's that?
So what happens here now that it's being held in October? Next year in 2022, does it go back to April?
Yes, it goes back to April.
Okay.
And one of the problems here is that the day before, this Sunday is the Chicago Marathon, and last Sunday was the London Marathon. So they have gotten some of the elite people to come and run here. But you know, people don't run marathons every day. There's a long time to downtime and to recover and then to train again.
That's
why they spread out. Yes, so it goes back to April next year.
And then the following month, New York City, they run their marathon.
You're right. Yep.
So all that's going on. And you're right. With all that going on, the Red Sox, the marathon, traveling by foot probably will be the best way to get around Boston.
Yep.
FIFA Scarlett, I'm sure your boys play these games, this video game. Let me explain right quick. FIFA soccer video games. They've hundreds of millions of copies worldwide, and now that may cease to exist in the current form after their publisher, EA Sports, is in the game, said it was considering renaming them.
I know. So what happens here? Does it just become some kind of generic EA soccer game or EA football game? That would be confusing to anyone who's American. But people don't talk about their video games in terms of, oh, I want to play the soccer game. They say, I want to play FIFA 21, you know, or FIFA 20. Yeah. I know my kids would say, I want to play NHL 21. Right. So losing that licensing or renaming the game changes everything.
I mean, do they name it like it's Madden in football? Do they do it Ronaldo? Do they do it Pele? Do they pick up some world famous name in soccer?
You just end up confusing people.
If Madden works for football, would another name work for the beautiful game?
Well, maybe, but you'd have to you'd have to educate a whole lot of people about how it's the same game, but it's just, oh, we lost the naming rights. I mean, it's. I don't know that kids have that attention span.
You brought up a good point, and I didn't think about that. It's like when we call these video games, yeah, I'm going to play FIFA 2022. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play Madden. We don't think of it, oh, yeah, let me grab that soccer game
right
off the shelf.
Yeah, let me play the football game. Let me play the soccer game. I want to play baseball. You know, it's like, oh, no, MLB 22. Because, of course, there are different editions, right? And in some versions of the game, like the player that you like has better stats and does better than in, you know, the game 2 years ago. So that's how everyone refers to it.
I'm going to play Monopoly 2002. Coming up today, we're speaking with MLB Network lead analyst Harold Reynolds. And I'm excited to talk with this gentleman. And his perspective on the game is second to none. Mr. Reynolds, welcome to Bloomberg's Business of Sports again.
Hey, thanks for the kind intro. We'll see if it's still there at the end of this thing. Thank you.
Well, let me ask about your thoughts about this baseball season. It's exciting. If you want excitement, think about what happened in the NL wild card game, drama upon drama. Can you take us through what this season has been?
Yeah, you know, it has been an exciting year. You know, it's hard to believe that we only played 60 games last year, and so you're playing 162. So the challenge first off was going to be, how do you stretch guys basically from 0 to 60 or all the way adding another 100 games? You know, how healthy will guys be? How much pitching can you get? That type of stuff. I thought the players stepped up. The teams played really well. And we're seeing it now in the postseason. You look at the wild card game with the Dodgers and the Cardinals, that really kind of talked about the season. You know, you had great pitching, you had a home run, and, you know, you had some great defense. And that's really what you're looking for in a baseball season. It was a very competitive game.
What about the business of baseball? I mean, the teams now have fans back in the stands, clear contrast to what we had last year, a full season. How does it feel to be covering the sport again? Do you kind of just not ignore what happened last year, but everything is in comparison to 2019 when it was last normal?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you have to go back to 2019 to look at it, but it was great having fans back in the stands. I mean, one, the energy was off the charts, but you look at also just on the business side, from ticket sales to jersey sales. You know, you look at Mookie Betts, once again, the highest selling jersey, and you know, he's becoming a international star here, and just watching the growth of players. And really, clearly, on the field, I thought because fans were in the stands, it just took the excitement level of the game to another level as well. So, revenues are up. Everything was really good. It was a really solid year.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hey, Harold, it's Mike Lynch up in Boston. Of course, we're pretty happy up here these days.
Not so much here.
You know, it's the start of football season. Everybody loves to watch football. Major League Baseball could not have scripted a better wild card matchup, then Red Sox Yankees, and now you've got the Dodgers and Cardinals with the Dodgers winning, and now you've set up the second greatest rivalry in baseball, Dodgers and Giants. This has got to be a huge, huge leap for Major League Baseball in every phase.
Well, you mentioned the bad word in football because, you know, they've really figured everything out. You know, they've got it rolling with from revenue to fan viewership, you name it. So, yeah, they're a competitive model now. And for baseball to land with the rivalries you just talked about and then heading to the Giants and Dodgers and having that, we needed it. You know, it's one thing to have fans back in the stands, but you want to have interest in your product. And clearly – those teams are going to draw people. You either love them or you hate them, but you got to watch them. And so we needed that. And really, if you look at it across the board, generally speaking, the Dodgers and you know, the Yankees and the Red Sox, and we got high payroll teams that are, you know, really have the most stars on the clubs. So that's an attraction for fans as well. So it was very important to get off to that good start. And the matchups really fell right for baseball.
And it's not just baseball that needed the crowd. All of those guys, the vendors, the restaurants and the bars that are around these stadiums, they are very thankful to have the fans back.
Well, I'm glad you touched on that, because if you look at the what's happening around the ballparks, it's the creativity of the properties around them. You know, like St. Louis, I know that game was played in Los Angeles, but that whole pavilion they built in St. Louis where you can watch games. Boston's transformed Fenway Park, that whole area. You know, so that's really the model that a lot of these major league teams are going to. All-Star Game was in Denver this year, and that whole area now around Coors Field is built up where 10 years ago that was not the case. So, again, I know we're talking about revenue and we're talking about fans' appreciation and viewership and drawing people to games, but it's also the venues around that keep those people there. And I know that's one of the things the Miami Marlins are looking at, is that their stadium is right there in Little Havana. And if people leave that area to go home, they don't come back to the game. So they're trying to create that area as well where you're going to keep people around. I think that's the model for most major league teams moving forward. I just think of the new venues like San Diego has done that, and you know, that's what we're starting to see now, and I think it's important for the sport, and it's also been a fun place to go for a fan to be able to hang out and stay right around the ballpark.
Yeah, but, I mean, in contrast to that, then you have Tampa, right? I mean, Tropicana Field is not winning a lot of fans, and they're now...
Now, why are you going there on that with me?
They're talking up the possibility of splitting the season with Montreal, and there's a lot going on there. What is it that Tampa needs to get back on track, aside from a new stadium, which seems to be everyone's answer to something like this?
Yeah, it was kind of hard to get away from the new stadium. And it's not necessarily just the new stadium, but it's the location. Mm. And even though I talked about the other ballparks, it's the location of those parks that have made them work and made them sustainable. Tampa's just in an area that doesn't make a lot of sense for that demographic and that region to draw. So it's always going to come back to the stadium there. And I think that's why baseball is open enough to say, yeah, we'll explore the possibility of going to Montreal.
Does that add to the value of the franchise, or does it take away from it?
Depends on the franchise. If it's sustainable, you're going to add to it. I mean, I'll take the Toronto Blue Jays, for example. I played 10 years in Seattle. And when we played the Blue Jays, it was like a home game for every Canadian. You know, they all came down to Seattle, and there would be more fans that were Blue Jay fans than there were Mariner fans. So could you imagine if the Blue Jays said, hey, we're going to play half our games in Vancouver, and then we'll play the other half in Toronto? In that case, I think they would sell out everywhere they went in Canada. But I don't know if that works for Tampa to be in Tampa and say we're going to go to Montreal, mm-hmm. where you don't have that identification. So I think it depends on the franchise.
Yeah, it's about to – I got to go there. It's time to talk about collective bargaining. Will there be – let's put it this way. Will there be a work stoppage?
Well, honestly, I really don't know. It's been difficult, I think. If you look at what's happened so far, what transpired with trying to work agreements to get the players on the field during the pandemic, it didn't go smooth. that you would think. You look at hockey, they did it real quick. Hey, we're in a pandemic. Let's move it a couple of years. We'll figure it out. That has not happened. And so it's different. We have not had a work stoppage in, you know, 20-some years in baseball. And I spent 4 years of my 12-year major league career either locked out or in three strikes. So it wasn't pretty. That has not been the case in the last 20-some years. So the fact that there has not been a work stoppage in 20-some years makes me feel optimistic to work something out. But I just don't know at this point in time.
Who's more incentivized to strike a deal, the players or the owners?
Look, our game cannot afford a work stoppage.
But both sides seem to be bracing for one.
They do seem to be bracing for one, no doubt. Well, anytime you have a work stoppage, it falls on the owners as far as bad publicity. And I think we got a different group of ownership than when I was playing. You know, I played for the guy that was like, hey, this is my family team. My grandma passed it down to my grandpa. And, you know, now it's corporations that own it. So you've got a little different incentive and a different direction. I think when I was playing, it was more of the players were really how you were going to make a lot of money. I think this ownership group understands they're making money outside of this.
Mm.
And I think they understand also that the players are going to help you continue to increase your revenue. Before, as a player, I just felt like it was always about the team and not the individual. You know, today we're promoting the individual player a lot more. You hear about Soto, you hear about Acuna, you know, you hear about that more so than you hear about the Atlanta Braves or the Washington Nationals. And so that makes me feel like this ownership group understands marketing. It understands monetizing their asset, which is the players. And so I think they really are willing to be partners in that sense.
Harold, with a mandate for a vaccination be a deal breaker for the players' side?
I don't know. I know there's a number of players. There's a number of teams that have not got to that point yet. Personally, I'm all for the mandate. I think we need to be vaccinating players. And if we're asking employees across the board, you know, here at MLB Network, you can't go in our building unless you're vaccinated. And the same thing's happening with ball clubs doing that with all their employees. But why would players receive special treatment? I don't see that. So I think if we're going to get through this pandemic and we really believe that we're all in for it, then, you know, the mandates are working. And hopefully I would think that would not be a deal breaker. I think I would hope that the union would look at it as something that we need to do. But I know that they fight for individual rights all the time, and they may view it totally different than I do.
Kurt Flood has to be looking down when we talk about free agency, because back in his day, it was totally different. He was the man that helped drive to put this to where it is today. First of all, with free agency for players, where's that status? And second of all, when you talk about big names like a Max Scherzer or Clayton Kershaw, where do you think they'll end up?
Well, the revenues are so high now. It's hard. Like when I was going through it, the minimum salary in Major League Baseball is $30,000. You know, so to tell the common man we're fighting for more money, he understood that. When the minimum salary now is $500,000 and the average salary is over $2.5-3 million, it's hard for people to sit there. And we got like several players making over $100 million and probably a handful that make over $300 million. I think it's kind of hard to sell fans on we're striking because we need more money, you know, or need more things that we need to get. So that makes it very difficult of an argument. And so when it comes to free agency, we clearly all owe Kurt Flood a debt of gratitude just for what he went through and fought for. And I'm hoping today's player understands that when you go through these certain things, it's not for you, it's for the next generation moving forward. And so as they continue to push the envelope, I would hope that they would look at and recognize they need to bring the bottom up. The top is getting a lot of money already. I mean, you've got a minimum salary, like I said, of $500,000, but you've got probably 1,000 players at that minimum compared to the 50, 60, 100 players that are way above the threshold of 100 million. So I think that's where they got to go to, is bring the bottom players up and share that wealth.
Do you think free agency works better in baseball than, say, in football? I just think of how at the start of this football season, there's so much drama surrounding signings. I mean, how would you grade free agency in the MLB versus in the NFL?
Well, baseball is the model. Everybody's followed baseball. So I think baseball's got it right. I know that the one thing you might discuss or see discussed is the age limit or the years of service. That might be something that everybody talks about. But as a model for free agency and determining that, baseball's got the best. You know, you look at football, they had a linebacker last week from the Cowboys get released after he signed a $70 million contract. It's still not guaranteed. Baseball, if doesn't matter if Lindor has another bad season, he's getting his $341 million. You know, it's a guaranteed contract. And so that's the difference when it comes to free agency. The model that baseball put in is that money is guaranteed. And that's the difference, and I think every sport's striving for that.
Analytics in baseball. And I remember I used to have the old Strat-O-Matic baseball game, and that's it. Those were the analytics that you had. And now, today, you have so many data services providing this for fantasy sports players. It has totally changed today. What do you think about it?
Well, it's definitely changed the game. It's not going anywhere. I mean, we got a saying at the network, if you don't understand analytics, you're going to be out of the game real quick. And so it's a different language. I do see when it first came in, there was a lot of confusion and a lot of fight. It's been a little overbearing, I think, at times. I think there's a little bit too much. The game's a lot simpler than they try to make it. Nothing irritates me more than watching a player looking in his hat to see where to stand when you play the guy 20 times.
Oh,
excuse me.
Right.
I think you know where he's going to hit the ball. You know, so things like that drive me nuts. Like the Kevin Kiermaier play, right? When he slid in, he took the card and everybody lost their minds. I'm like, they've played 18 times. Okay. I don't know what he can have on that card that they don't already know. You know, so I think there's a little bit over. But what analytics has done, they've done a great job of being an identifier, telling you what weaknesses are, what needs to be worked on, and things like that. The detriment, I think, is we've gotten rid of the problem solvers. It's one thing to have a guy tell you, hey, Harold, you're chasing the ball. Your chase rate is terrible. You're chasing this many pitches out of the zone. But can't sit there and tell you how to fix it.
No solutions, yeah.
You've got to have somebody who can fix it for you. And so I think we're starting now to bring back a lot more baseball instructors, baseball people that make sense of the numbers. And I think the game's really starting to turn, and it's getting better because of it all.
I got to ask you about the length of the games. I'm a hockey fan, and an average hockey game is about 2 hours, 20 minutes. The NFL, there's not a lot of action. There's a lot of people huddling and you know, very exciting meetings, or not. That's about 3 hours, 12 minutes. The NBA is, you know, really fast, 2 hours, 11 minutes. The MLB, 3 hours and 10 minutes, and that's on a good day, it feels like. I mean, if you have a playoff game that begins at 8:07, first pitch, how do you get people to watch knowing that the ending won't come until probably after 11 p.m. on the East Coast when the kids need to go to bed?
Well, it's a challenge, no doubt about it. But I think the answer is in the excitement of the game. If the ball's in play and there's activity, then it goes by, right? And people are engaged in it. When baseball runs into problems, is ball one, ball two, ball three, ball four, walk, next batter, foul ball, and full count.
You forgot the meeting on the mound.
And the meeting on the mound. And before you know it, the ball has not been in play in 5 minutes. You know, that's the challenge. There's no action. So I think if there's action and things happening, nobody's really worried about the 3 hours. But if not, then it's a problem. And then the other thing I hope we look into at baseball is starting games a little bit earlier, you know, because, I mean, we're losing a younger generation who can't stay up and watch the end of the games. You know, as a kid who grew up on the West Coast, you know, one of my favorite things was to watch a World Series game, and it might be at 9 a.m. Eastern, and it started, 9 a.m. Pacific, and it started at noon Eastern, and I watched the whole game. So now we're starting games later for prime time and advertisement. I get it, but I think it's difficult for kids to be able to stay up, and we got to figure out that puzzle to reach that next generation.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So Harold, what drives me crazy too, I played high school, I played college baseball, the meeting on the mound. Can they just eliminate, can you imagine every time if Tom Brady threw three incomplete passes that Bill Belichick called timeout, went out to the huddle and talked to him for 2 or 3 minutes, and then the referee came over and said, "That's enough, Bill, let's go." And then he threw three more incompletions and he went out and visited him again. Why can't there be just the way you signal third base coach or the catcher, what signs you want? Can't you do the same thing to the pitcher from the dugout? Can we eliminate this team meeting at the mound? It might save 10 or 15 minutes per game.
Or add VR to it, right? Add some technology to it and make it more interesting and exciting.
We'll put up an earpiece. How about an earpiece in the pitcher? Would that ever work, Harold?
You guys are touching on everything. There's actually a company working on that with Major League Baseball right now. So, one, let's tackle the first part. They've cut down the mound meetings now because you do have a limit on how many times you can go there. Secondly, the technology is a big part. They're using it now in the minor leagues a little bit as a test where the catcher, you see those wrist guards all the time, like the quarterbacks. But inside this one, you actually have an electronic grid that you can hit the buttons like, okay, this is a fastball down the way. This is a curveball up and in, whatever. Although hopefully you don't throw a curveball up and in. But you have these different things on the wrist guard that you can go to the pitch. And there's an earpiece that goes in the hat that the pitcher can hear, and it goes, curveball, down and away. And if he shakes his head no, then he pushes another sequence, and it goes fastball, up and in. And here's the cool part of it, that baseball being such an international game and so many people come from different parts of the world, that let's say my shortstop is fluent in Spanish. They can have that in Spanish for him to hear what the pitches are. And my second base is from Japan, so they can have that in Japanese. So they're making it in everybody's native tongue, and you can do those type of things. So we're getting there. I think the technology is moving it forward, and they're doing it and test it in the minor leagues, and guys are loving it. So that will help speed up the game, no doubt. And it's pretty cool to do as well.
This leads into the next question.
What'd you think of that?
I like that. I like that, man. That would be, I could just see the guy holding the hat on his head right now. It's like, wait, I'm getting the signal here. It's like, that would be good, man. That'd be cool.
Yeah,
what do you think about?
They're not looking in their hat for, okay, what did you say?
And before we get to Michael's next question, somebody, and it might have been my former intern, it might have been Carl Ravitch who said it, but he called it a cheat sheet. Which I think is the worst moniker you want to have in baseball right now is a cheat sheet, right? With all that's going on with the Astros and the Red Sox, right?
You're absolutely right. Call it something else.
I mean, what happened to the bench coach said, okay, shade over a little bit to left center field. Okay, shade over more towards the line. This guy's a pull hitter. What was wrong with all that? Why do we need these little cheat sheets and helmets in the back pocket?
It infuriates me. I'll tell you guys a quick story. I played with Cal Ripken in Baltimore, and every time the catcher would put a sign down, Cal's played 2,000-some games, and he's sequencing in his head how to get a guy out. And I would hear him at short, like, no! If it wasn't the sign he thought it should be. So we're playing. We get close to Toronto, the Joe Carter walk-off team, and now we're back in the race. And it's late August, and we got a 4-game homestand. And Ben McDonald has the bases loaded. Cal comes to the mound. We're all there. Pitching coach came out. Pitching coach goes back. I hear a whistle. And I look up, and Cal's still at the mound. We go back. He goes, I'm calling all the pitches. Fastball, and he touches his hat. Chest, he touches his breaking ball, and down his leg is going to be a fastball. So I'm standing at second. I'm looking at Cal. A catcher's looking at Cal, and he's calling all the pitches. there's certain ways to do it.
Yeah.
My point is, he didn't have a cue card in his head to figure out where to stand and what a guy might hit. So
that's kind of the way we used to do it on the old field, man, when I was a kid, man, playing baseball, man. That brings me to the next point. I love to get more youth into the game in terms of getting the kids to get more excited about baseball. How do we do that?
Well, I think you touched on it, you know, when you were a kid, you know, on the sand lot or out in the field or whatever, you guys called your own pitches, your own plays. What's happening now, I see it in youth baseball, is you got all these coaches controlling the game. I want to tell every coach, you didn't do that, have that when your parent, when you were playing. Let the kids call games, play the game, because it's a game. And I think that's why soccer has taken off so much. You know, I have younger kids who are playing soccer. The coach isn't yelling, left foot, right foot. No, they're playing. But in baseball, we're sitting there going, elbow up, don't swing, do this, do that. And it's like, let the kids play and figure out the game for themselves. And then you will engage them in saying, this is fun, instead of feeling like this is more of a chore than something to enjoy. So I think
I'm glad you bring that up, because every youth sport has some kind of travel team circuit. I mean, my kids play hockey and they're on travel teams for years. I feel like it kind of crushes that idea of let the kids have fun, because it professionalizes it to the extent that it can. And you can't just be an average kid who wants to try out a sport and learn how to play and enjoy it, right? You have to be fully committed for that season and during the off season as well. There's spring hockey, there's summer hockey, and I'm sure there's the same for every sport. Is that a hindrance?
Well, no doubt about it, it is. And I have younger kids who played, and I remember my youngest when he was 10 years old. He's a great athlete, playing different sports. He wanted to play everything. But that coach, whatever the season was, would say, oh, he's got to be here all year round. And I'd have to fight them. Mm-hmm. At 10, I don't know what he's going to do. He doesn't even know. Let him figure it out. And the last thing I'll throw out there, I live in Montclair, New Jersey, and we had a wiffle ball tournament that was a fundraiser for one of the travel teams. Mm-hmm. And the coolest thing was the kids picked their own teams, 3 or 4 kids on a team, and it was a whole town. And they played wiffle ball. And no coaches, no parents. It was the kids picking the teams and playing through a tournament. And it was the coolest thing. So I think we got to let kids play. I think we got to get back to local sports, not all this travel stuff, but let it be affordable where kids can play locally. You don't have to travel to be found. And that's the thing we got to continue to change.
I love that. You don't have to travel to be found. Harold, I want to ask you about whether you watch ManningCast, Peyton and Eli Manning on Monday Night Football or on the sidelines of Monday Night Football. I mean, what do you learn from that? Because people are saying that they're revolutionizing sports broadcasting. And as a sports broadcaster, when you watch them, what do you learn from them? And what do you want to take away from that and implement into your own broadcast?
Well, we started doing a little bit of that early in the summer. We call it CC Game. CC Sabathia sits with a group of his former teammates and watch a game. And what I take away from it is we've taken away the guy who's telling us all the obvious stuff that's on the screen already. You know, why do you have to tell me, here comes the 3-1? You know, I already see it. It's up there on the screen. You know, so what that does is there's only so much time to speak and talk. Now what Peyton and Eli have done, and I really think it started with Tony Romo. The reason Tony Romo is so great is Jim Nantz lets him talk. You know, he's talking, uh-oh, look at here. It's going to be an open on the flat right there, instead of Jim Nantz going, this is 3rd and 10, and this is, you know. They let Tony talk. And so I think what happened with Peyton and Eli is they got the clicker. They're taking fans inside their thinking. But they're talking, and they're not talking about the obvious that's up on the screen. We can all read. And so I think that's why it's been so engaging. You're listening to the players are taking you into the huddle, into the mindset of the competitiveness, and they're telling us what's going to happen before it happens because they're seeing it. And that's the beauty of it. And so I think that's why it's been so engaging.
So take me inside the Tampa Bay Rays. How are they so successful every year with one of the lowest payrolls in baseball? Year after year after year. They went to the World Series last year. And analytics probably cost them the World Series last year, by the way, when Kevin Cash came out and got Charlie Morton. But that's another story. How have they been able to be so competitive, Harold?
Well, they've got a model that works. I think one thing they've done real well is they basically have said, we're not signing high-priced free agents. Here's what we're going to do. And they've been able to develop and take their top-tier prospects all the way back to B.J. Upton and trade them. You know, Longoria traded them to keep this wheel going, and they get back prime talent. And when that talent gets to a point where they're going to be making big money, they're able to spin them off to the big market teams and get their prospects. So they've been able to keep that going. But I think discipline has really been a big part of it. You know, you talked about, you know, taking your starting pitcher out of the World Series when he's on a roll. And that was what got them there. I don't know if I can say, this got us here, this is what we're doing. But that's what they do. And here they are once again, you know, charging through the playoffs and really taking down the big dollar teams in the Red Sox and the Yankees.
Well, you know you always have a welcome home with us, man. Harold Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us here on the Bloomberg Business of Sports. Always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, guys. Such great questions and so needed. So thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Harold Reynolds is always very interesting to talk to, and just so many thoughts that go through my head. Scarlett, what did you take away from this?
I see him all the time, and I hear him all the time when I'm watching baseball games, so it was kind of fascinating to be able to talk to him and just get the lay of the land on things. What I liked was the inside baseball, haha, no pun intended, of him admiring Eli and Peyton Manning's broadcast and what they're doing and how he might be able to incorporate some of that into what he does day in and day out.
Lindsay, what did you think?
Well, when you started to talk about the labor agreement expiring, most ex-players are ex-players for life. They're union guys. They stand by it. And he seemed to think that the game of baseball is broken and needs to be fixed. And there has to be some flexibility with the players' union, especially with mandatory vaccinations, all this big money that they are making. Because they are losing fans and young boys and girls to lacrosse in the spring, and football season is when the playoffs are happening in baseball, and they need people to reconnect with the game of baseball. So I like the fact that he's all in for the good of the game, not the rights of the players and ex-players.
I always loved it, the Curt Flood, when we talk about the free agency, and he said all the players in this league need to thank Curt Flood and understand what he did for them. And back in the day, when the average salary for a baseball player, like he said, was about $30,000, the average person could understand, okay, I get why you want more money. But now when you're making just oodles and oodles of money, it's harder for the average fan to say, okay, go out there and make more money.
I also thought it was interesting that he said the current ownership of MLB teams has evolved to understand that the players are the stars, and it's not the team brand that sells seats that gets people into stadiums. And so they work with that. They understand that the players make a lot of their money, if not most of their money, off the field.
Yeah.
And they work with that as opposed to resisting it.
That's like the NBA talking right there, because the players are the stars, mm-hmm. and like you said, it's like the team is like, okay. Well.
But you know, the MLB is more tied to tradition than, say, the NFL or the other leagues. I mean, baseball is all about how it's always been done, right?
I've always said this is the way the Tigers have always done it.
Had to bring them in.
Yes, of course.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
You know what it's time for now, everybody.
Oh boy, here we go.
Let's huddle around the set. Come on, children, let's go. It's time to play the number of the week. So let me set this up. Chris Taylor, he had a dramatic walk-off home run in the NL wildcard game to advance the Dodgers to the NLDS against the Giants. Now, as we've been talking about salaries, according to Roto World and Baseball Prospectus, Taylor signed a 2-year deal with Los Angeles for how much?
What position does he play? Lynchy, do you know?
I forgot.
Chris Taylor. That's a good.
Is he a left-handed batter, right-handed batter, switch hitter?
Is he a right-handed batter?
No, he's right-handed.
Power hitter or hits for average?
He's been hitting well this season.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know baseball players' salaries, so I'll just throw this out there. What you said? 2 years.
Here, let's see.
$20 million.
You said 20 million, eh?
Yeah.
Do I get the guess?
You get the guess.
He's gonna get it.
2 year contract. Let's see. $6.5 million, $6 million. No, $13 million.
What? No.
What?
No.
The answer is $13.4 million, and it's all guaranteed. I don't know how Lynchy does this. I really don't know how.
Why don't
he
we have
Lynchy
come up with the question, the number of the week next week, and then you and I can guess.
I'll screw it up. It'll be what was the question again? I'll mess it all up. I don't see how you. That's all guaranteed. I mean, that's amazing. I give it up for him. This has been the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. We're here each and every week at the same time, plus online wherever you get your podcast. And you can catch those Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
I'm Scarlett Fu at Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at Lynchy WCBB.
Thank you again for joining us. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big money in the world of sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.